Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library. For those of you who may not know this yet, my goal here at the library is to make the lions roar, to make this institution levitate. I'd like to mention some of the upcoming programs we have, including this February 29th on Tuesday, a conversation with Krista Tippett, the host of Public Radio's Speaking of Faith, and Stuart Brown, the founder of the National Institute for Play. They will discuss the importance of play. For instance, Dr. Brown, who worked with criminals, discovered that what they all had in common is that they didn't engage in their young years in play. Our evening on January 30th with Bernard Schlink has unfortunately needed to be cancelled for health reasons. Upcoming, we have Samantha Power with Azar Nafisi, Nicholson Baker, Pico Aya. I invite you to join our email list so you may find out more about our upcoming events. Peter Sellers will be joining us later this year, Slavoj Žižek, Lee Siegel, the Penn World Voices Festival, and to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Ian Fleming, A Night with Bond, James Bond, Shaken but Not Stirred. That will be sometime in May or in June. I'm not quite sure how that evening will be put together, but I promise you a lot of fun. We're looking for a few Bond girls. We would like to thank 192 Books. They are our bookseller partner now for the second season. 192 Books is located at 192 10th Avenue. Both John Richardson and Robert Hughes will be signing books after the event. Please go to that table after the event. Become a friend or even better, sponsor of the New York Public Library and receive discounts off all future live tickets. It is an honor to welcome tonight John Richardson, the author of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Picasso, Provence, and Douglas Cooper, Sacred Monsters, Sacred Masters, Breton, Capote, Dali, Picasso, Freud, Warhol, and more. And for more, most recently, Volume 3 of A Life of Picasso, The Triumphant Years, 1917-1932. And Robert Hughes, who was the art critic for Time for 30-some years and the author of The Culture of Complaint, a book I absolutely adore, The Shock of the New, American Visions, and Australia Beyond the Fatal Shore. Most recently, he has written a terrific memoir, Things I Didn't Know, and is presently writing a book about Rome. It is good to welcome him back to the stage. Last time, he was joined here by R. Crumb. Tonight's conversation, The Paradox of Picasso and the Role of the Biographer, will address, I believe, the question Sartre put to himself when he wrote in The Idiot of the Family, his three-volume study of Flaubert published in 1971. Sartre asked himself, what can one know about a man today? Anyone would tell you that Gustave Flaubert is also of Madame Bovary. But what is the relationship between the man and his work? Now we must begin. But how? Where shall I start? It does not matter. One enters into the dead as one enters into a windmill. For the first time meeting on stage, John Richardson and Robert Hughes, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to welcome them tonight.
Where do we kick off? You've been working on this now for...
10 years.
10 years. Almost since adolescence.
Exactly. Second adolescence.
Second adolescence. What enabled you at the outset to take on this, I think, prodigious task? I mean, here you are with one of the great emblematic lives of the 20th century. And not only that, but also a life which has defeated innumerable writers. I mean, when I think of the number of bad books that have been written about Picasso, it's...
but they were most, those were mostly written when he was still alive. And the one good book, Roland Penrose's book, suffers from only one fault, and that is there are no shadows. He didn't dare put them in because he loved Picasso, and Picasso was still alive.
He didn't dare put them in... Because he loved Picasso, or perhaps because he didn't know about them?
No, he knew about them. I mean, Roland was as close to as Picasso as any of the other writers. And Roland was terrified of offending Picasso. So here's this excellent book, and the facts are pretty accurate, and it's a very good perceptive account. But he didn't dare add the shadows. I've added the shadows, but I've also added a hell of a lot of highlights.
You knew him quite well, did you not?
I know him pretty well from most of the 50s and on into the 60s, and when I came to live over here. But I used to see him because I lived not too far away with Douglas Cooper, and I used to... Well, he used to come over to us because we were halfway between the two bullfight centres, Arles and Nîmes. And so we would always go and have lunch before the bullfight, go to the bullfight, and then Picasso would come for dinner afterwards with the bullfighters, usually with Cocteau and various sort of hangers-on and friends. And that was great fun. And then we'd go over to him. So, I mean, from really most of the 50s on into the 60s. And I'd always wanted to write about him, but I really started to think, how can I write about him? And I was going to do a book on the various women in his life, because Dora Maar had told me that when the woman changed, everything else changed. The style changed, the house changed, the dog changed, the friends changed, the cook changed. I mean, everything changed.
Now, was this in fact true, or was it just what I thought?
It was pretty true.
Yeah.
I started doing a book a lot, but it seemed to draw a thin line to follow, so I ended up writing a proper biography.
Well, the problem with doing the book as you initially envisaged it surely must have been that it placed the onus for Picasso's change and therefore his development upon others rather than himself.
Yes.
Or not? I mean, if you ascribe change in a character who obviously was a very strong guy to his relations with others.
Well, it wasn't to others. It was really basically to the woman. And the woman, in each case, the mistress, for better or worse, had an enormous influence on his life, the way he lived, and on his work, on his imagery. And the changes would start with the woman. I mean, I was around when he, just after Francois Gillot had left him, and the three women in his life. It was like the judgment of Paris. And who was going to get the apple? And Jacqueline, in those days she was called Jacqueline Roque, was the sort of not far from being the favorite. And there were two other women, and I was around, and we traveled with Picasso to Perpignan, and all these visits were the sort of pre-judgment of Paris, and everybody said, Jacqueline's not going to get it. Il n'est pas la hauteur de la tâche. She's not up to it. In fact, she was very much up to it, and I knew she was going to get it. And so I really would see it through her eyes and how she, her appearance, I mean, Picasso was sorry for the fact that she had really no neck. So the early portraits have long necks, you know. And
there's not a lot that a prospective husband can do about that.
Well, you can paint her with a long neck, for God's sake.
Yeah, up to a point, yes.
And that's where this thing worked so well, the faults, whether it's faults, but the slight lacks of this, that, and the other in certain of the women, he could make up for them. He could, they wanted to look rich and chic. I mean, he'd do it. If he was in a bad temper, he would give them a very rough time.
His relations to the women in his life, which you discuss a lot in this trilogy so far, have been very much, in the past, have been very much caricatured, have they not?
Well, they've been, yes. I mean, not so much caricatured as got completely wrong. I mean, above all, the nature of Olga, his wife, people simply swept under the rug.
This is something I particularly wanted to ask you about, because in the past, in the books of, you know, including Penrose's, I might say, all the books on Picasso that I've read, and I can't say that I spend my life reading books on Picasso, but still, they all seem to present Olga as being this, narcissistic, brainless Russian bitch who only cared about getting freebies from couturiers. And yet, the portrait that you draw in Volume 3 is far more solid and nuanced than that. What was it that you found out particularly about Olga Hochleba that enabled you to produce her as this three-dimensional, solid character rather than the phantom of snobbery?
Well, I think what happened was that nobody knew much about her at all, and her grandson, Bernard, the one, Picasso's one legitimate grandson, was a good friend of mine, and he handed me for the first time her archive, and I had her photographs, I had her cabin trunk, which she never travelled without, huge old-time wardrobe trunk with drawers and clothes hangers.
Oh, one of those old Vuitton-type trunks.
Yeah. Yeah. And it had, I mean, it still had her old tutus in it and costumes, and except the drawers were filled. It was incredibly sad, this thing. I mean, there would be endless photographs of Picasso. There would be press cuttings of her. And I happened to be around when she was dying, and she came to die near him in Cannes. And every day there would be messages from her saying, I mean, she had to see him before she died. And she was screaming for him because all she had left or wanted to have with her in the world was this huge cabin trunk, and she'd pull the drawers up and go through these hundreds of photographs, sobbing and screaming for him. And Picasso simply wouldn't go and see her.
It sounds like a sort of nightmare Russian parody of Miss Havisham in Dickens.
Well, yeah, a sort of Miss Havisham on the move.
Yeah, with porters.
With porters, yes. And she carried her tragedy with her. And
would not be parted from it.
And would not be parted from it. And
she had no life after Picasso, essentially.
None. I never actually met her, but just after the World War II, I used to go to Paris, and I was whatever it was, 21, 22, and I used to stay in a cheap hotel in the Rue des Beaux-Arts called the Hôtel de Nice, and I used to have demi-pension, and I had a friend who stayed there too, and we used to have lunch every day. And there was this sad, gloomy woman in the corner of the room. We used to fantasize about her. Why was she so sad? Why did she look so tragic? What was wrong with her? And then the last day when I was going back to London, the porter came through and said, telephone pour Madame Picasso. Hey. And that was it. I mean, she rushed through, and that was that. And God, I wish I'd been known and I could have talked to her. But I have had, thanks to Bernard, you have these all kinds of sort of memorabilia and endless letters in Russian from her family, which Bernard's getting translated at the moment. And we're going to know much more about her, because nobody knew a damn thing. She told a lot of lies. She said she was the daughter of a Russian general.
But I think all Russian expatriates said that, didn't they?
Well, probably. I mean, except there are a lot of Russian patriots who spotted her immediately. That's no daughter of a Russian colonel, a general. That's a colonel's daughter, and he worked for the railroad lines. And so when I got onto the whole Bemberg story, which is in the book, and Georges Bemberg had married a very well-born white Russian lady, and whose daughter I was able to interview. And I said, well, I imagine your mother, as a Russian, must have known Olga well. And she said, no, but my mother would never have had her in the house. And this wasn't out of snobbery. This was out of the fact that Olga was sashaying around, dressed from top to toe in Chanel, with jewellery and so on, and the sort of grand white Russians were driving cabs or washing dishes in restaurants.
Tell me something. What, in your reading of it, was the attraction that the... I mean, granted, she was a handsome woman... Granted, she had talent as a dancer, but so did a lot of people in those days and still today. What was it that you think commended her particularly to Picasso? Why was he so influenced by her? Because he clearly was.
She was so respectable. That's what turned him on. I mean, he didn't want one of these Montmartre or Montparnasse girls who, you know, had been through a lot of hands. He wanted to marry a virgin who was respectable, who was sort of, who would be a prior, who his family would approve of. And
that is, Spanish family.
His Spanish family, yeah. And that's what he liked about her. I mean, the fact that she wasn't one of these old sluts from
or young sluts.
Well, they're young sluts.
I want to put in a word for sluts, but you never met her, but you must have known people who, other than Picasso, who did know her. Did she have some sort of mojo? Did she have some sort of magic which was apparent to the uninvolved spectator?
Olga. She had sort of ballerina magic. I mean, she had, you know...
Oh, I loved one of those.
she had, obviously on the stage, I mean, she was also extremely intelligent. And Nijinsky, when he was choreographing L'Après-midi d'un Faune, which has exceedingly complicated steps in it, and you have to be able to sort of count and follow different rhythms and so on, and she had no difficulty doing that. I mean, Nijinsky said she was marvelous as one of the nymphs in L'Après-midi d'un Faune for that reason. So she had something. I mean, and she also had, there are photographs of her where she looks like every other sort of grand ballerina. I mean, she's...
She's posing.
She's posing, yes. And I think that he was mad. She was very, very pretty. I'm not saying beautiful. I mean, she was a very pretty woman.
Yeah.
She was very virginal, which turned him on.
Which must have turned him on like
crazy. Because he'd never had been confronted with the problem of virginity before. I mean, he'd always...
Even when it was not, in fact, a problem.
What?
Even when it was not, in fact, much of a problem.
When it was not in problem. Mm. And, I mean, she said, you know... Diaghilev said to him, you know, a Russian girl, you have to marry her. No way you can, you know, go to bed with her before. And that also was a challenge to Picasso. But she got him. And he was, for the first sort of 3 or 4 years, devoted, and this is what, in a way, he felt, you know, he was so proud of her. And this is especially proud in view of his Spanish family.
I got this really classy chick.
Yep. Now, exactly. Yeah. Have you ever found yourself saying that?
Well, I found myself thinking that, but not saying it. I don't know. See, there is a tendency to... We mustn't stay too long on Olga Korkleva, but, I mean, there's an interesting matter here because it has always tended to be the case that people think that the paintings that he did under the aegis, as it were, of Olga are inferior to the... they're not as good, they're not as radical, they're not as... stylistically striking as the ones that he did before and indeed after. But you don't take that view, do you?
Well, the view is he hadn't got into that particular rhythm with the women in his life. With Olga, he starts off idealizing her and she becomes a neoclassic icon. And he sees her as a sort of grande dame, and he sees her formerly as very stylish and very beautiful and so on, and never as a nude. She's always fully dressed, and she's always looking very cool. She's never sort of looking sexy, particularly. In fact, she's looking remarkably unsexy.
So she's not a bit like those magnificent droptical nudes that he...
No, not at all.
They've come after her.
Well, they're she's around when a lot of them are painted. But I think what where his strengths come out is when she's become very hysterical. She was a very sick woman. and they got into these terrible fights. And then he paints these marvellous paintings of her, which are as cruel as anything in Goya.
They're monster pictures.
Monster pictures.
And they alternate with the beautiful nymph pictures, the ones of total sexual satisfaction and relaxation.
Of the other girl,
of my dress. Of the other girl.
Yes.
Speak to that, will you?
Well, I think that you cannot understand the late 20s and on into the 30s in Picasso's work without realizing that he had a wife who was extremely comme il faut, extremely conventional, and he had a mistress on the other side who he was madly in love with, who was very erotic and whom he inspired some of his most wonderful images. And the trouble with Olga was that he'd given up seeing her as a sort of grande dame and then saw her as this monster, I mean, with the vagina dentata head, and she is ripped apart. I mean, the fact that she'd not broken her leg, we don't know exactly what happened, but a month before they were due to get married, Olga had some kind of tendons or something, and she was in plaster for a long time, and she was on a stick when she was married. And the fact that Olga, I mean, can you imagine being a Russian ballerina
on a
stick at a Russian marriage? And there you are. And that cast a shadow over the whole of the rest of the marriage, because the honeymoon, I mean, she was on a chaise longue and not able to get around and not able to roll around,
yes.
More important. And that was tragic. But after 1927, when he picks up Marie-Thérèse, the murderous paintings of the wife and the gorgeous erotic paintings of the mistress kind of counterbalance each other in some extraordinary way. And you can't...
Well, one produces the other in an extraordinary way.
They do,
way.
Yes. And that's what's so crucial. And the paintings of Marie-Thérèse, to my mind, sometimes, I mean, like The Dream... It's a bit sentimental. It's a bit sort of over-romanticized. I mean, where Picasso gives it as a Picassian touch is with the form of her head takes the form of a rather large penis. So she's called, it's the dream, it's called. And she has
and that's
indeed...
that's what she's thinking about.
She's got sex on her mind, literally. And also there are other vaginal signs, I mean, which he makes in the painting, which sort of hots it up. But it's a romantic painting, as are most of the ones of Marie-Thérèse. And in the last resort, I don't find that they're as terrifying and moving and amazing and stylistically experimental as the late nasty ones.
Am I wrong in thinking that the Picasso that moves you most intently, because it certainly seems to come out in the book, is the Picasso of supreme anxiety? Not that the pictures of, you know, which connote sexual fulfillment and relaxation are without their punch, but the ones that seem to come through most vividly in your account of his life are the ones which are scary.
Well, I think so, because what I don't think previous biographers had realized was to what extent Picasso was a shaman. To what extent he saw himself as a witch doctor with his sculpture as fetishes. And a witch doctor doesn't sell his fetishes, and nor did Picasso sell his sculptures. I mean, during his lifetime, very, very few of the sculptures were sold. And I think that that's what I think I hope I brought to life a bit, was this side of this magical side of Picasso.
Well, you did, but you see, one of the things that I'm so curious about is the extent to which your experience of Picasso leads you to believe that he believed that his images had actual power over the actual world.
Well,
which is a shamanistic belief. In fact, it's the essence of shamanism.
He sometimes faked it a bit, in that I remember going there one day to the studio, and he said, you know, I'm a prophet. some half jokingly, and I said, "Oh," he said, "look at this drawing I did," and it was a drawing of Marie Therese, and the background was fever chart pink. You know that thing you get at the bottom of your bed if you're in a hospital?
Yes.
And it goes like that. And there were other colours, and there was this terrifying background, a fever chart background. And then there was this wonderful, moving, tough image of his wife, Jacqueline, looking absolutely desperate. He said, "You see, she's sick in that portrait, isn't it?" And do you realise she was perfectly well when I painted it? And 4 days later, she had a fever of 40 degrees or
yeah, whatever it was.
Whatever it was. And I think she was a very obedient girl, as was Marie Therese. And I think she saw from what was on the easel that she'd better have a fever quick. And I think that, well, it's not quite as crass and crude as that, but it was something along those lines.
But if you spend your time, if you spend in the belief that by projecting your own fantasies of mood or state of health onto your partner and the partner responds, then it only strengthens your belief in your omnipotence, doesn't it?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that was the pattern of a great many of Picasso's relationships with women.
Was a power relationship.
Yes.
Not that others are not, but it was conspicuously so.
Well, he used to get them to read. All the girls in his life were supposed to read, I don't know which of the Marquis de Sade novels, but, I mean, at least. And where he was clever with Marie Therese, she said later when she was interviewed by a friend of mine, she said, "Oh, you know, he likes all these sort of Sadean things." But she said, "I put up with it because it's all about art, isn't it?"
Yes. Well, yes, it is, actually. I thought you were going to say that she said, "Well, I was going to, but I can't read."
No, it's a great excuse.
Oh, my God. The taking off from there, do you think that that there were certain unvarying cultural requirements, as it were, such as being acquainted with Sade and Sade's ideas, but others too, which Picasso expected of those he was close to? And I don't mean necessarily his lovers. I mean, there is a widespread belief that we respond to certain traits in males or females to whom we're close.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to isolate, to generalize to the point where you can isolate such expectations in Picasso?
Well, I think that he's obviously what's called a control freak, but more important than that was that he was... there was a sort of slightly Dracula side to him in that he needed other people's energy. I mean, if he were here, he'd want everybody's energy. He'd do anything he could to get this sort of energy from friends, from people he was with. And this wasn't necessarily from mistresses or anybody else. This was, I mean, I remember so often spending a day with him, and there would be three or four people who didn't know him particularly well. And he had different strokes for different blokes. And by the end of the day, he would have got everybody and got their energy. And from children, old ladies, guys, I don't know. I mean, he was amazing in that respect. And you always were amazed at the end of a day how you were suffering from nervous exhaustion. And you'd had nothing exhausting to do. You'd gone to the beach. He'd shown you a lot of stuff. You'd had a good dinner. But it was, he'd got something out of everybody. And at the age of 85 or whatever it was, would go strutting off into the studio on stolen energy.
Did you ever see him suffer from nervous exhaustion?
No, I heard him suffering from nervous exhaustion.
Under what circumstances?
When he was doing the the versions of the Velázquez, of the Meninas.
Oh, Las Meninas.
Las Meninas. And as was his way, I mean, this was at the California in an upstairs studio, and he'd kind of isolated himself and become more and more sort of obsessive and angry and tortured and creative. And you'd hear him stamping around. And I'd be downstairs sitting with Jacqueline, and she always had the same word for Picasso when he was like this, l'abominable homme des neiges.
The abominable snowman.
The abominable snowman is up there. Listen to him banging around, crashing around. And so I heard this, but rather than saw it.
But it wasn't a common feature of your...
No. I mean, with his friends, Picasso was the best possible friend you could ever have. I mean, he was very warm. There was no sort of arrogance about him. He was very relaxed. I mean, he'd talk away about anything. He was incredibly funny. He had all little tricks of sort of, I mean, you...
He was a great mimic, wasn't he?
He was a great mimic, and a fiendish mimic, too. And he'd pick up, I remember we were having lunch one day, and there was a tongue on the table, and he'd slices of tongue, and he'd hold it up. You know, our tongue has a big sort of meaty bit and then a lot of nasty sort of leg at the bottom. Held it up, said, portrait of Vollard. And it was. It just was. And life was full of those sort of things. And then he liked to go to the beach and draw on the beach, especially if there was a dealer around. And he'd infuriate the dealers by doing the most elaborate drawing when the tide was lapping up, you know. And he'd add, no, I have to do a bit more, no, no, no. And then the tide would wash over it and the dealers would say, why the hell do you do this? I mean, why don't you
tough
do it on
shit,
paper?
Yeah. I wonder if he were to come back, what things about him would he have read that he thought told a certain truth? Apart from your book, which I'm sure he would have subscribed to.
He would have hated that, by the way.
Do you think he would?
Hated it, yes.
Why?
Because he didn't like the truth about himself.
Yeah.
He liked to control the truth about himself.
Yes.
And that's why Roland's book is not better.
Roland Penrose.
Because, I mean, you know, Roland didn't dare cross this line. And I had the advantage of doing it after his death.
Mm.
And I think almost everybody, good friends, good... I'll tell you who's good, is Hélène Parmelin, the wife of...
Oh, really?
Of that...
Pignon.
And she...
Who was the favourite painter of the French Communist Party
exactly.
At the time that Picasso was a party member in the 50s.
But
Pamela was the wife of Pignon, and she wrote a book.
She was Polish.
Yeah.
And she wrote three books about Picasso. And she was Polish, and we only now know that she was reporting to the Russians all the time. I mean, there were three wives of French intellectuals, who was the other ones? Nadia Léger, married to Léger, and they had to report back to Stalin.
Oh, really?
So they were greatly encouraged, and you know they became great ladies in Russia and Soviet Russia.
And worked their way in.
But they had to pay a high price for it.
Was Pamela's friendship with Picasso, did that have anything to do with that famous and extraordinarily silly image of Stalin that Picasso did to celebrate his birthday? I mean, Picasso had no need to toe a party line, and yet he did. And yet he basically was a fairly apolitical creature.
Well,
according to your book.
Well, he was an apolitical, totally apolitical. He tried to stay above everything. And people who say that he was this and that and the other in the early years of his life, completely wrong. Picasso used to say publicly, what am I? I'm a Spaniard. Spain is a kingdom, and therefore I'm a royalist. I mean, this is a cop-out, but in fact, he just wanted to stay above things. In reality, his political views, such as they were sort of old-fashioned liberal values.
Did he vote?
He lived out of Spain. I don't think he ever didn't vote in France. And
well, there was nobody to vote for if he would have.
And it was only, I mean, in 1934, when the fascists get in and the guy was killed at the beginning of the war, the fascist. Antonio
Lorca.
Antonio, the fascist guy.
What you mean, Franco?
Prima de Rivera. Antonio Prima de Rivera, who invented the phalange, and he was Andalusian like Picasso, and he invited Picasso to come to San Sebastian to this party given by the cultural branch of the phalange, and Picasso went. And this is one of the discoveries I'm in a way proudest of, because nobody had spotted this. And he went in his car with his wife and his son to San Sebastian, and to an old friend, his Argentinian friend Otero, he said, when I realized what I got myself into, I immediately took the next train back to Paris. In fact, the records show he stayed on for another 4 days and had a very jolly time being
flattered
and flattered, and also being promised a retrospective in Spain.
At the Prado.
It would have been, I suppose, at the Prado. Yeah. But that's basically what he wanted, and he'd seen. And ultimately, it was the other side. I mean, it was the Republicans who did give him a show. But he wanted, above all, he was prepared to do anything to have a show in a retrospective in Spain.
A real painter.
Yeah. And then he didn't become a communist until 45, until the end of the war. And that was such a strange story, because Dora Maar told me that Picasso was so excited by the de Gaulle liberating Paris, and that he became passionately pro-de Gaulle. And so the Gaullists heard about this, and I think one of the Gaullist henchmen said to Picasso, why don't you come and have dinner with us tomorrow night, and you'll meet the boys, and you know, and we'll get to know us. And Dora said Picasso went off and came back, said, sitting bon de con. I mean, he said they're horrors. I couldn't possibly...
A bunch of shit.
And joined the Communist Party 2 days later.
That doesn't sound like the action of a highly politically responsive man.
Exactly.
No.
And going back to the portrait of Stalin, I mean, that was... a man called Taslitsky, who was the art man in the Communist Party, who helped arrange art exhibitions and so on. And before he died, I interviewed him. And he said that Picasso was one of les trois mousquetaires, the three musketeers, and there was Picasso, Aragon, and Joliot-Curie. These were the three musketeers, and they were always...
Joliot-Curie for science, Aragon for poetry, and Picasso for visual arts.
And these three were trotted out, and they were obedient, and they allowed themselves to be trotted out. And then Picasso is asked to do the portrait of Stalin, and does this sort of idealized portrait, which the communists or the Soviets regarded as horrendous. And everybody got into trouble. It was a total mess. But I remember when I was seeing Picasso in the 50s, he never denied being a communist, but he never did anything apart from the occasional appearance. He gave a lot of money to the communist newspaper on the coast, on the Riviera, had holiday homes for communist kids or something, and he gave a lot of money to that. But otherwise, he didn't do anything for the
money, of course, he could well afford. I mean, he was, I presume, well, at least until Damien Hirst, the richest artist who's ever lived. Yeah.
Well, I think he was. In the 30s, he had, in the Banque de France, he had these two huge bank vaults.
Yes, you have this extraordinary story in your
which
book.
Comes from Servoz.
Yeah.
And Servoz, he showed him everything in one bank vault, said, would you like to come and see what's next door? And there was just nothing but parcels. Because I said, these are all banknotes. And it showed him one, opened one.
What, they were bricks of...
They were bricks of and I think they soon went out of circulation and probably had to be burnt on a bonfire. I mean,
but the sort of sight that you wouldn't get to see until the days of big, big-scale cocaine dealing.
Yes. He became very, very rich. And when he was young, he used to have a huge sort of purse on a big safety pin or a sort of button. And in order to pay for a meal or something, he had to get it out, open the safety pin, you know, get the money out. And there was a sort of almost sort of peasant sort of stingy money under the mattress side in those days. But latterly, he was unbelievably generous. I mean, he kept a huge hospital going after during the Spanish Civil War at Toulouse, which he paid for, entirely. And
this was a hospital for people who were wounded or ill as a result, on the Republican side.
Yes. Mm. But he was very generous by nature with everybody except his family. And the trouble...
Yeah, tell us about that, because it squares peculiarly with the... I'd heard probably just from you that he was as...
Well, he
mean
wanted
with his family.
He wanted to control his family, and the easiest way to control them was through money.
Mm.
And so he
generally
really,
is...
So he kept them. He was stingy with them. He was very, very generous to incredibly generous to his friends, and to all kinds of good causes. And he had a sort of pension thing. A lot of people, Spaniards who refugees, people who ex mistresses. I mean, they all got some cash, and this was doled out through his banker Max Pelker and through Kahnweiler. And he was extremely generous. But again, what's difficult about Picasso, whatever you say, the reverse is also true. I mean, he was extremely generous, but he was also could be exceedingly stingy. He was, at heart, a black Spanish Catholic, but he always claimed to be an atheist.
He was intensely superstitious, wasn't he?
Intensely superstitious. And not
Can
any...
you speak to that?
Well... He picked up superstitions as he went along. I mean, he had a whole... After marrying Olga, who was also, like so many Russians, very superstitious, he ended up adopting all Olga's superstitions, particularly the one about before you go on a journey, you sit still for a minute or 2 minutes in silence. And... and if anybody giggled or yawned or grunted or anything, they'd have to start all over again.
You had to start over again, yeah.
And they didn't like that very much.
What about hats on the bed?
Well, that's a prostitute's superstition.
I was just whores, we believe that.
Yeah, because it means no more work.
Of course, yeah. No, I thought it meant bad luck in a general kind
well,
of way.
No, well, it's come to believe that, but it always, I mean, it's a sort of Victorian whore's superstition. I've always understood. maybe misinformed. I don't think I am.
I'm sure not. I wonder how... I wonder whether a character like this would be... even a possibility in the art world we've got today?
I don't think so. I don't think it would be. I mean, I agree with you. I don't think it would be possible.
Why would it not?
I it's impossible to say. I mean, I can't just can't see him in the art world today. That's maybe why I say this. I mean, I don't think...
Why can't you?
I can't see him because no good artists anymore start by being poor. And so much of Picasso's feeling for the art market and for the... all came from being absolutely poor, from having to... to suffer like mad.
And regarding dealers as a bunch of predatory crooks.
And he was taken for a ride by, not that they don't take people for a ride today.
No, I was about to say.
He really suffered so appallingly from this. And this coloured his whole life. I think you'd never find a dealer like Kahnweiler again, I mean, who was as brilliant. I mean, he'd studied art history. I mean, he was an enormously cultivated man. And he was also his. He came from a family of bankers, and so he had all the qualifications. And there are no dealers today who have those particular qualifications that I know of. And I think the he's so unlike the artists who make it today. I mean, he was nothing in common with.
Well, very talented for a start.
Yes.
But go on, I'm sorry.
You go on. I want to hear more. I want to hear you go.
Please don't
come
give
on, Bob,
me.
Rant away. We want to hear about
what you want.
What you feel about.
You want me to do a rap on these animali and
Stronzi? The Diamond Skull. What you feel about Damien Hirst's Diamond Skull?
The splendours of this world surpass my ability to describe it. I just don't know. You would have needed somebody who was a genuine fiction writer to come up with an explanation of that. I think that you are wanting to bring us to an end.
No, not at all. I want you now really to ramp.
No, I want John. You see, John bridges these worlds much more effectively than I do because I, you know, first of all, I didn't know Picasso, but also how can I put this delicately? I'm a bit younger than you, not that much, but somewhat.
And I'm years younger than me. I'm going to be 84 next month.
Well, yeah, but I'm going to be 70 this coming year, so it's only 14 years. Yeah, it's not much, but it's a long slice of time in the... in the evolution, or I suppose we would say devolution, of the art world. Because anybody who could have foreseen, if anybody had said to me 10 years ago that some big shot is going to be paying $100 million for a Klimt or a Pollock, I would have said, oh, come on, mate, you're fantasizing. You know, that's never, ever going to happen. And, of course, I would have been totally wrong. I mean, there is no assumption you can make about future prices, not because the works of art get more wonderful, but because money loses its value and prestige accumulates to the point where it's meaningless.
But what's so tragic these days is that... I mean, in the days of Cubism, there were just a few extremely cultivated collectors, I mean, who knew what Picasso was up to, and they bought very seriously. Now, you have a lot of people who've made, you know,
billions.
Several millions a year, you know, and they don't know how to live. So the only thing they know how to do is buy paintings that advertise their wealth.
Yes.
And they have to be big, they have to be eye-catching, they have to scream, I'm a Picasso, from the wall. And so you get bad pictures on the whole. You get flashy pictures, and you get Andy Warhol, who I'm a great admirer of. I know you aren't, but I mean, Andy's sort of flashier works go for these insane prices. And, I mean, anybody in the right mind in the art market will buy old masters these days, because you can get, this morning was sold a wreck, actually a marvellous wreck, which was a Georges Latour, but I thought
was
that,
it?
Yes, and it's the only one to appear. But it was, you know, it hadn't been restored. It was really smashed up, and it went, I think, for 3.5 million or 5 million, but it went 4 million. But it was a beautiful small painting. But I mean, that. What would you get for 3.5 million in the for Damien Hirst? You get a lot of butterflies.
Yeah, you might get a small fetal shark. I don't know. I mean, kids coming into this cultural environment, were I one of them, I would be so, instead of the ancient shellback with no other employment possibilities that I am, I would have just shied away from it. I mean, I would have found it so alienating to contemplate being part of this weird scenario with people who know nothing about art running around paying unheard of prices for undesirable things. God. And I'm sure, at least I think, you would have felt the same way too. It is surprising to me that this has not produced its great sequel to La Commedia Umana.
Yes. And no great figure is... I mean, Damien Hirst is a brilliant businessman, but I think...
I'm sure he is.
I think that's about all one can say. I mean, the art wasn't... I thought it was quite stimulating, and he had some ideas earlier on. I liked all those sort of... The drug cabinets with the, you know...
up to a point.
Headache things at the top, and the toe stuff at the bottom of the shelf, and... I thought that was whimsical, and it's all about the Emperor's new clothes, basically.
Sort of. Well, at any rate, the Emperor's new tailor. Yeah. Anyway,
do we need any questions from the?
Yeah, let's throw the floor open to. I have no idea what time it is.
What this? Anybody want to
hop in?
Ouch.
Yeah, I see you. Ooh, look.
Given Picasso's enormous sense of self, what was his feelings about his mortality?
Picasso was terrified of death. You couldn't mention the death of anybody in front of him, or you had to be very careful about it. He was terrified, so terrified, that in his studio he had a wall of bird cages. There were a lot of bird cages, and he had all these little birds in them. And we were having lunch one day, and there was a little plop, and one of the birds fell dead from its perch. And Jacqueline he was a bit deaf, Picasso, took the cage off the wall, took it down to the kitchen, told the driver to go down into Cannes, get a new bird, and it was back on the wall before the end of dinner, and before the end of lunch. And a week or two later, I heard Picasso saying, "Here are my birds." He said, "They're immortal."
This, I take it, we will see in volume 4.
Yeah, but the fear of death took a rather unfortunate form in that he wouldn't make a will, because that implied recognizing the fact of his own death. And he wouldn't adopt his illegitimate children, but for exactly the same reason. And so... when he died, there was total confusion, which I think he probably was very happy about. I mean, I feel that Picasso is still spinning in his grave doing things, because things keep on happening. I mean, to his children, his grandchildren, and some are good and some are bad. And they are all the result of his not making a will and not recognizing his children.
Did he think that in some form his consciousness would survive death, or did you never get to talk about that?
We couldn't talk about it. I mean, you know, with death you couldn't talk about it. But I think that he was also... He wanted to go on working, and he did go on working within a few weeks of
dying. Well, I mean, so do we all, but...
He did go on. I mean, he didn't taper off and do sort of a weak, miserable drawings or painting. I mean, they became more and more weird and strange and hallucinatory, but he went on pretty much to the end. But he was terrified of death, and I know that my old friend Douglas Cooper was thrown out for good and all when he suggested that Picasso should recognize Paul and Paloma, Claude and Paloma.
Really?
He didn't like to be any mention of this at all.
Sir?
Yes, hi. Would you speak to the history of Picasso with Max Jacob, the early days? And was it a betrayal of Max Jacob in that he ended up being taken by the Nazis?
Picasso loved Max Jacob, and Max Jacob, who absolutely penniless, rescued Picasso when he was even more penniless and took him to live with him in this room, and where they shared a bed. And this story has always been sort of rather cleaned up, that, you know, Max Jacob slept in it at night and Picasso during the day, or vice versa. But, I mean, they in fact shared the bed, and Picasso did tell a friend of mine that Max Jacob was extremely homosexual, and that the one person who he had done something with was in fact Max Jacob. And Max Jacob was a drunk. When Picasso's mistress, Eva, died in 1915, Max Jacob, there was a funeral ceremony, and there was a procession to the graveyard, and Max Jacob got drunk and made off with the cab driver who was driving the hearse. I mean, and Picasso never forgave him for that. But they then became... He did forgive him. But Max Jacob became, oddly enough, rather very right-wing, and appeared in one of the Falange, one of the fascist magazines, cultural paper, newspapers. During the war, Max Jacob's, I think his sister and a brother were taken off to Auschwitz. And Max Jacob was arrested and taken to Drancy, and he managed to get a message out to Cocteau and Picasso. And this is where people have told a lot of lies. Cocteau, a collaborator, and was... what was so difficult about Cocteau's thing is that he was a collaborator, but he used his German friends and so on to save people who were Jewish or were in the resistance. And he did remarkably good things during the war. With Max Jacob, he went to the famous old actor who was also a collaborator, and they managed to get the order rescinded. But by the time they got to Max Jacob, he died of pneumonia, I think. But Picasso wanted to do something to help. But everybody said to Picasso, for God's sake, don't shut up, don't do a thing. Listen, you are the icon of anti-fascism. I mean, if you poke your nose into this whole thing, I mean, they may, you know, take him away and kill him. But, I mean, it'll be no help to anybody, so just keep quiet. And we will take care of it. And Cocteau, indeed, did take care of it. But this fact has got sort of twisted round against Picasso, that Picasso was disloyal and did nothing to help Max Jacob in his hour of need. But I mean,
well, the version that I heard was, I forget from whom, was that somebody came to Picasso and said, Jacob is in prison and he's going to be on the train soon. And Picasso allegedly replied, well, he is a poet. Poets have wings. Let him fly out of there.
Well, I think he probably did say that. I mean, it's very Picassoian, but it doesn't imply any... I mean, Picasso was desperate. I mean, this is his oldest French friend. Of course he would... And he was very, very loyal, Picasso. And he did make, I mean, it's very Spanish, as you know well.
Well, indeed.
To make a wisecrack.
A wisecrack of that sort.
Automatically, I mean, a Spaniard does it. And I don't think we can hold him to task for that.
No, I only interject it.
No, so that's what I feel about the Mike Sharkov situation. Anything
yes,
else?
Thank you so much for this evening of this rare connoisseurship and personal stories and scholarship. I've always wondered, Picasso seemed to have so many American friends, starting with Gertrude Stein, the Murphys, and then on the Riviera with Fitzgerald, Cole Porter, and that crowd. And he's shown here in 1911 with Stieglitz. And, of course, the big retrospective with Barr. Why was it that he never came to America? And did he like Americans? And also the soldier that he befriended right after the war, who then
James
had
Lord.
Two volumes of his photography with him and spent all that time with him?
James Lord? Or David Douglas Duncan?
Yes.
Could be David Douglas Duncan.
Yes.
Yeah. First of all, about travel. He hated to travel. I mean, he said he could do all the traveling he wanted in his mind. He liked traveling. I mean, inside France, he traveled around. But he went to Rome twice, both not for long. He went, when he joined the Communist Party, went for the Peace Congress in Wrocław, in Poland, and then he went to one in Rome and one in Sheffield in England. But basically, he hated travel. When war broke out, American friends and collectors tried to get him to come to America, and Swiss collectors tried to get him to go to Switzerland. English collectors, Roland Penrose, tried to get him to spend the war there. He said, no, I can't bear to be away from France. And he stayed on at the risk of his own life. Picasso was terrified of authority, terrified of the police, of the bang at the door in the night. I mean, he knew he was on the Ministry of the Interior's sort of lists, and there was he had a big dossier. But it didn't. Somehow he got over his fear of this and stayed on in occupied France, and which was amazingly his. Courageous of him to have done, because the...
Could it have been that he was afraid to leave his paintings? Didn't he have them in a vault?
Yes, I mean, in the Banque de France, he had these huge vaults of his paintings. But no, that was part of it, but his whole life was there.
What was his take on Americans and American collectors?
His take on American collectors is so much comical, in that... He liked the Ganses, Victor and Sally Gans, very much. But occasionally the rather grand collectors, people would say, oh, I'd like to bring Mr. Paley or Mr. Whitney or whoever it was. And Picasso would say, oh, I've no time to see any more collectors. And also I have my American collector. His American collector was a man from Chicago. I've forgotten his name. He manufactured a product which made Afro-Americans take the kink out of their hair. And then when it became...
Newman.
And Mr. Newman had made 200 watches, which went, instead of having numerals, P-A-B-L-O-P-I-C-A-S-S-O, I mean, for the time, and gave them to Picasso. And Picasso adored Mr. Newman. I mean, he said, I've got Mr. Newman. I mean, I don't need any more American collectors. And Newman did have a staggering collection of modern painting. And then Picasso one day offered Mrs. Newman a Gauloise, a cigarette. And she said, oh, Pablo, I couldn't smoke anything you gave me. Will you sign it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Very difficult to do. Signing a cigarette.
It rolls away, yes. And, as I remember.
So he signed it. And it was kept under a red velvet cushion under a cloche in their apartment. And Picasso loved the Newmans. And but he did also love the Bars above all, the Ganses and the French collectors. I mean, Lefebvre and so on. Any more?
Yes, hi. I was curious about Picasso's interest in movies, especially in the later years, or his thoughts about them as an art form, and also all the people coming in the 50s and 60s to Cannes, and a lot of Americans showed up, bought houses, movie people came there. If he had a relationship with them, and if he really had an interest or not in movies as an art.
He had a tremendous interest in movies. He loved movies. He loved Chaplin. Pre-1914, he went regularly to movies and enjoyed all that very much. And I think that movies, as I wrote in an earlier volume, that the close-ups in early Cubist, the Prague 1907 self-portrait is clearly a close-up out of a movie. I mean, you get, and there's the huge eyes you get in close-ups and so on. I mean, he used this thing. There was this show which people, I mean, at the Pace Gallery last year, which was rather fascinating, but I think it tried to see rather too much of movie influence in Picasso's work, and to see Cubist still lives in terms of
movie montage,
movie, you know, cameras, which I don't go along with. But he also liked movie stars. He liked Gary Cooper, and Gary Cooper came to see him. He was terribly disappointed when Gary Cooper gave him a pair of guns and didn't know how to, you know, do that.
Gave him a free he gave him a Colt 45.
Yeah, yes, I think it was.
About which the late Mr. Mailer wrote an essay called Picasso's Pistol.
Oh, I never read that.
Yes. He rather envied that pistol.
Well, I mean, apparently, you know, all that thing you see in the films, he seems to draw very quickly. In real life,
oh, he's struggled to get
no earthly good of trying to get this thing going. And he's very fond I've forgotten the name of the movie star he liked very much.
Well, Cooper, was it the bloke or a girl?
Cooper was the bloke.
Yeah, no, I know, but I... also, I've been told. Was it an actress that he...
He liked that husband and wife team. I mean, the husband was, I think, was also a singer, and the wife was, she was in, oh, so many, I've forgotten her name, anyway. Enough. What he liked latterly, I mean, in old age, he liked kind of really corny old movies like The Bengal Lancers, I remember. There's even a drawing of the scenes of The Bengal Lancers fantasizing about the girls who are waiting, these houris, these Indian girls who were waiting sort of next door for the Bengal Lancers to have a go at them.
I have a question. You were talking about how Picasso was very generous with his friends and not so generous with his family. And then you commented that he was using that attitude as a way to control his family. I was just wondering if you could talk about a little bit about what he was trying to control and about, what kind of a father he was to his kids.
Uh,
Not a very good father, I'm afraid. I mean, Polo... he loved Polo, I think, his one legitimate son when he was young. Later on, when Polo, it wasn't altogether surprising that he really became a kind of what, like kids are today, took to dope, ran off to Switzerland, did everything in the book that was sort of what he shouldn't have done.
Well, it's hard having a dad like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Damned hard stuff to live up to.
Yes.
Or to live under, I should say.
And when his nephews, the Vilato boys, do you know Javier and Finn? They were his sister's kids, and they came to Paris at one point. They lived in Paris quite a bit. And when they were young, they didn't have any money, and they said, please give us some money, we want to be painters and so on. He said, listen, go out and sell your bodies, be gigolos. They were...
Shocked.
Said they were shocked by this.
Well, I would be
that's
too.
Not what uncles are supposed to say.
It's not what he did either.
But can be criticised was that he, to get back at women friends, former mistresses, he would take it out on the children. His way of getting back at the mother was to get back at the children, and he would never have Claude or Paloma around. And I talked to Paloma about this, and she said how tragic it was. She hadn't been allowed to see him for 10 years, and she was in Cannes, and she saw him getting out of a car, and she rushed towards him, and he grabbed her, and she said it was exactly as if they'd seen each other yesterday. And then Jacqueline said, come on, we've got to go, come on, slammed the door, and that was that. And I think that Jacqueline, I'm afraid, whom I was very fond of, but she was extremely, she was not a good with Picasso's family.
Well, she was exceedingly possessive, I gather, yeah?
Well, she's possessive of him. And,
of him? Yes. She did not want any competition from the past.
Well, also, she wanted him to have perfect peace and quiet in which to work. And she was prepared to do anything he wanted. I mean, I think that a lot of those very late paintings of women in sort of weird possessions and so on, I'm sure that he got Jacqueline to sort of model for them.
Yes.
Hello. Of all the artists of the past, it always struck me that Goya loomed largest for Picasso. And given the fact that we have a Goya and Picasso specialist in dialogue, I wonder if both of you could address that a little bit. And
do you want us both to talk at the same time?
As you wish.
No, John.
Well, I can do it my side rather briefly. I think Goya was the one Spanish painter Picasso was rather terrified of. And he lays off him. Even Velázquez, he did versions of. He never did any versions, really, of Goya's paintings. And I think that they were very, very similar in lots of ways.
Certain ways they were.
Yeah.
Picasso and Goya?
Yeah, Picasso and Goya.
Because Picasso and Velázquez could hardly have been more dissimilar.
No.
I think what happens is that you get a two people about whom one has no matter how you define the term, you can't avoid using the term great artist, both of them. If they are dissimilar, it's possible for one to imagine variations on the other, as Picasso did with Velázquez. Because they were totally unlike. Here is Velázquez, this immense courtier, this prodigious social climber, this, genius of refinement and precision on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have Picasso, who really does not give a flying what's it about social climbing or about his position in court or anything like that, and yet nevertheless wishes to dominate his audience by virtue of the cult of his personality. As far as we know nothing about Velázquez's personality. We couldn't have a conversation like this about Velázquez's personality. No. On the other hand, you have the, a guy like Goya, and who was unlike Velázquez in another way. He has a tremendously powerful black side, as Picasso did too. We don't know about Velázquez's sense of doom and fear, loathing or anything like that. Picasso makes this a major subject of his work and his life, as Goya does. It is therefore inevitable, I think, that there will be a very intense posthumous relationship between Picasso and Goya. For Picasso, Goya is the man to rival, and Velázquez is not. Picasso can pay any quantity of homage to Velázquez, but his homages to Goya are very uneasy.
I think there's a tremendous hidden competitiveness.
Yes, absolutely. And not always so well hidden.
The ghost of Goya, I think, haunts Picasso.
Yeah.
And Picasso didn't... He almost never...
The ghost of Roger Casement is beating on the door.
But I don't think he ever really gets down and dirty with Goya. I mean,
oh, absolutely not. I mean, you compare his bullfight, the two men's bullfights.
Yeah.
What do we see, you know? I mean, Picasso certainly knows who Pepe Illo, the great toreador, was. But, the idea that he would make any toreador who was as memorable as Goya's toreadors, no, he never does that.
Well, except the bulls, and I think Picasso's bulls and Picasso's the picadors, which Goya doesn't.
Yeah, well,
doesn't.
They're not cows, but they're not Goya bulls either. I take that back, because there are some in the 30s.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's above all from
in the
34, 35 onwards. But the also Picasso put so much of himself into the bull and in the horse and in the picador. I mean, he's present, which I don't think Goya does so much.
Well, not in the same way. Mm. Although I think there are certain Goyas where you get, for instance, a horse which has just been disemboweled and, kind of standing there mutely, they strike me as being, if not autobiographical, certainly mm-hmm. having some relation to Goya's
yes.
own fears of powerlessness and anguish.
But Picasso's really, I mean, he's the bull or the... they change. Picasso's, you can say that Picasso... Well, Picasso himself said that the gored horse was the women in his life. But the gored horse is also called kinds of other things.
Well, yes.
And including himself.
Yeah.
And when things are going badly for Picasso, I mean, he's the gored horse. And then the mistress
and
is...
And Spain is the gored horse.
And Spain,
and the Republic
yeah.
is the gored
yeah.
horse. Yeah. Okay.